And we're back.
We're on schedule.
Hello, everyone. This is Liz.
And I'm Laura.
And you're listening to From X to Z,
a podcast where we have multi-generational conversations about things that matter.
And some that don't. But today we're talking about some things that matter.
I think it does matter.
But we're starting off with things that, I mean, it all matters.
It all matters. So I was going to say, I have something as well. To like something that doesn't matter, just something I've been thinking on, and I need some like feedback.
Okay.
So you go first.
Oh.
Or I can go first.
I'm intrigued now. You go first.
It's just a question, like okay. What you think.
Okay, ask. Okay. Ask away.
Okay. So I have been reading a lot of books this year.
Yes, you have.
Okay. So I decided to split it up into monthly TBRs, like a little list for each month. Okay.
What's a TBR?
To be read.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I have a conundrum.
Okay.
So at the end of March, I had a book that I was halfway through. Okay.
Okay.
And then I finished the last half in the month of April. What month would you consider that book to be logged in?
The month that you finished it.
Okay, I thought so too. It was the month that I finished it. But then I was like really bummed because I wanted one more book from my month before. So I was like, what do I do? That was my
life. But that would be a lie.
Ah, really?
Yeah, I think so. That's what you should do.
Okay, so it needs to go in April then.
I mean, really, you can do whichever one you want to.
No, I know. But what makes the most sense, especially if it's half and half... Or, what if you, like, read the whole book and you have one chapter left, you finish it in the next month? Is it still the next month?
Yes.
Oh, that makes me hurt.
I draw a hard line.
I'm staying up late to finish all my books in the month.
You'll be like, it's the last day of the month. Okay, but then you have to get it done before midnight.
I know. I'm going to have to stay up. To be, like, honest.
Yeah.
If I'm supposed to be an honest person.
If you want to be credible. If you want your TBR to be credible, which, you know, it's very important that it is.
Everyone cares. Yeah. So my integrity is not going to be correct if I lie on my TBR.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
because integrity is what you do when no one else is watching.
Right, exactly. And no one was watching when I put that book in March instead of April.
Honest you that you even brought that to everyone's attention here. So now we know... And
you're gonna keep me.
We're gonna hold you accountable for your TBR. All right. So on our last episode was about women talking. If you haven't listened to it, go listen to it. That if you haven't read the book, go read the book. If you haven't watched the movie, go watch the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good. But before that, we finished the episode and I was talking about something called Achoo syndrome.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't even know how it came up.
Oh, actually, this was like three episodes ago because our second was the missions.
Missions, yeah.
Okay.
So I was talking about Achoo syndrome because I was talking about how my children go outside and if they go into the sunlight, they start sneezing. And I thought that was really weird because my husband does the same thing. So I was like, there has to be something genetic here. Mm-hmm. And I Googled it and I found a different word for it, like photo something syndrome. But when we were recording our podcast, I Googled it to kind of get the verbiage right. And I saw that Achoo syndrome and I about lost my mind because I thought that is hilarious. And I didn't know if that was an acronym. Well, it is.
Okay.
It is an acronym for autosomal dominant compelling heliopathic outburst.
Wow. I would call it Achoo syndrome too.
Achoo syndrome. I feel like the Achoo came before the acronym. Like they were like, we have to call this Achoo.
Right. And then they just picked
and what can we do?
Right. Okay.
But I also said on that episode that I was going to share another weird genetic thing. So, okay. ASMR is like had its moment. I don't know if it still is having its moment or not, but I saw this. I can't even think of her name.
Those girls with those long fingernails are always having their moment.
Yeah, I can't listen to this episode now that I've done all that. Okay, so yeah, it's had its moment. It's having its moment, whatever. And I actually was watching something about this influencer and every post that she posts was ASMR type. voice, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I cannot follow her.
It's,
but anyway,
me, like, curl up into a fetal position. It
might just be my
here.
Voice. I don't know. But anyway,
so, okay,
okay. So, but when ASMR became a huge thing, and everybody was doing like ASMR parties, I was like, what the heck is like so compelling about this?
Yeah.
And so I would listen to some ASMR videos, and I would have this like rage in me, and I would be like, I want to punch someone in the face after listening to this. This is not soothing for me.
Yeah.
Whatsoever. And I had that response in any type of ASMR sound. And so I Googled it because that's what I do. And then I found that there is actually something called misophonia. Mm. And I am pretty sure that I have it.
I feel like you do from what you said.
Yeah. So misophonia is a condition. It's not in the DSM-4. So it's not like an actual like mental health diagnosis. Okay. But it is a condition characterized by intense emotional and physiological reactions to specific sounds, often those made by others, such as chewing, breathing, or tapping.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Oh my gosh, tapping?
Yes.
Okay, then Kellen has this, because I swear, I like, what's that thing called where you just kind of like
tapping.
Stimming?
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I will do that in the car. I don't know. Just, it's just, I don't know. I just do it. And he's like, you have to stop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This makes so much sense now.
Yeah. So my kids, if they are eating and they're chewing and I can hear it, I'm like, oh my gosh, you have to stop that.
Yeah.
Or if someone's like, this is just gross to me as a germaphobe, but if they're licking their fingers or something. But yeah, the whispering of ASMR. Oh, I'm like,
it's actually making me like
shiver. Oh my gosh. Yes. I cannot. Yeah. I cannot. And I remember having this reaction when I was little. Like, I remember being woken
before
up from
ASMR.
A nap.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was like in elementary school, and I was woken up from a nap from someone whispering. They were trying to be quiet. And I remember telling my mom that I wanted to punch something real hard. And she was like, why? I said, I don't know. I'm just so angry. And I remember, it's not because I was woken up from the nap. I didn't understand it, but I remember that it was such a visceral response where I was so enraged and angry, but I didn't know what was triggering it. ASMR. Isn't that interesting? And I'm not the only one. Like, apparently there are a lot of
like
other people.
Thing.
So, hey, if you are listening and you're like, I get this.
And you feel
I
validated.
Relate. Kellen, if you want to drop us a DM or something and be like, I get you. I hear you.
Oh, no. He's definitely going to be right there.
Yeah.
So,
anyway.
That's hysterical.
It's interesting. So,
well,
when people smack their lips. Oh, my gosh.
No, one of my friends cannot listen to me chew. And whenever, apparently I'm a loud breather whenever I eat too, which is so gross.
Well, the irony of it is that I think I'm a loud breather too, but I can't stand it.
You can't listen to anyone else.
Like, hold your breath, gosh.
A little hypocritical.
Stop
there.
Breathing. What's wrong with you? Anyway,
that's
okay,
so
moving on. Okay, so there's one more thing. I was having this whole conversation about phobias and weird things with my 13-year-old. And he said, do you know what hippopotamonstrosia quipodilophobia is?
No.
It's the fear of long words.
Oh, okay. Appropriate word for the long word fear.
The fear of long words is called hippopotamonstrosia quipodilophobia.
Okay. You say that so well.
I practice.
I practice. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I.
That's so funny.
Okay. So, speaking of all these like weird phobias and all of these
phonies.
Things, we're talking today about anxiety.
Yes, we are.
And how it presents in our lives, because Laura has suffered from anxiety. So have I. My husband, it's in our sphere and in our lives, and it is increasing in the world around us. There's also this book, The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, H-I-D-T. And I've read it, and it's come up in a lot of conversations mm-hmm. lately, whether it's church staff conversations. We went to a conference a couple weeks ago in Orlando, Exponential. They were talking about anxiety. Mm-hmm. This book in particular came up. So yeah, Gen Z is kind of being coined the anxious generation. But before that, millennials were referred to as the anxious generation. Mm-hmm. And so basically the gist is anxiety is everywhere yeah. and we're just getting more anxious.
The next generation, yeah. everyone's the anxious generation.
Yeah. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk a little bit about the book and some things that were in the book that I thought were good and eye-opening. But there's a lot of information in the book. I do highly recommend everyone reading this book. Yeah. Also, if you are a Gen Z, I recommend you reading it. If you have Gen Z in your life, mm-hmm. whether nieces, nephews, grandkids, or if you're a parent of a Gen Z, I just highly recommend that you read this. It is a secular book. It is not a Christian based book or anything like that. There's a lot of research in it, a lot of statistics in it.
Research.
Yeah, so highly recommend it. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today, but we're mostly just talking about anxiety.
This might be my next audiobook. I might have to listen to this one.
It's a good one.
I like the cover. It's an adolescent with smiley faces all around them, but they're looking on the phone. That's yeah. definitely one I would not pass by because it does have a nice cover.
Okay. So talking about anxiety, mm-hmm. what's your experience with anxiety? Like anything you want to share?
Okay. Well, let's just say I've always been an anxious person, right? Okay. It's interesting to see how stress and anxiety manifests in different people, you know? I remember when me and my sister had to go get shots when we were little. And I remember mom saying, well, she's going to react differently. Like, I would break out in full head-to-toe rash or hives my whole entire life. But my sister would react differently. So the last 6 months or so, I've had a lot of eczema. Mm. And it's been, like, a pain to get rid of. But, yeah. like, I was just so anxious. But, yeah, my... Mine, what is the word that I want? But
manifests itself
in other physical ways. Yeah, I've had panic attacks. That's not fun. I had can one you, this year.
Do you want to talk about or have? Can yeah, you I can. Talk about like a trigger, like mm-hmm. one of your panic attacks? You don't have to talk about like every trigger, but
probably the majority of my triggers is thinking about something in the future that is unknown.
Yeah. You know, I actually heard a definition. That's what I was kind of looking up right now, a definition of anxiety. The Mayo Clinic defines it as an intense, excessive, persistent worry and fear about everyday situations. Mm-hmm. But I recently heard that anxiety is the fear of the unknown or expected outcomes that may never happen.
Yes. Yeah. And you sent me actually a video on ADHD in women.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was expectation anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I feel so seen because every week I go and meet with someone and I work out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just once a week because, you know, I'm just once a week kind of girl. so I always get stressed out because it's on my lunch break.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, okay, I have to have enough energy for that. And then I have to make sure I eat well in the morning because then I have to have enough energy to sustain me through that.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever I come back, I need to change back to my work clothes and then I need to be back in time. It's just all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's so overwhelming and I don't dread my workout. Like I enjoy that, but I dread all the steps. Does that make
yes,
sense?
That does
and like
make sense.
Switching in and out of environments mm-hmm. and it's a lot of mental
mm-hmm.
exercising. And so there's a lot of anxiety with like, that's just like a day-to-day example,
mm-hmm.
but
Anticipatory anxiety.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, God says not to worry and not to fear, but it is like a valid real thing that, people struggle with. I struggle with.
Yeah, I think so too. ADHD is another interesting topic because mm-hmm. I have not been officially diagnosed with ADHD, but I am confident, very confident that I do have it,
yeah.
but I never thought I did because mm-hmm. The hyperactive part was like, I had friends who had ADHD. I had family members with ADHD and they were like, they couldn't sit still. They right. couldn't focus. They were very hyperactive physically.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I don't have any of that. I can sit still. I can pay attention. for the most part. And right. it doesn't look like that. So I thought, I don't have anything remotely like that. As an adult, also was reading something that a lot of times with women, your symptoms may present more, maybe heightened in adulthood because of hormones and things like that, especially like perimenopause. I'm not saying, but anyway, not that I'm there yet. or postpartum, like there's lots of things. But anyway, for me, the hyperactive part is mental, like my brain, like it doesn't stop. So it's just this constant, I'm constantly turning things over in my head or overthinking or having an internal conversation. It doesn't stop.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was normal because I've never talked to anybody else about what's going on in your brain. And then when we did Enneagram studies and I went through Enneagram coach training, I started learning all these different ways that people process. And I was like, wait. You mean not everybody thinks like this? Not everybody has this to-do list constantly running in their brain? Like, what? And so back to that ADHD reel, one of the things that really hit home for me was that anticipatory of if I've got something to do that day, like I think of nothing but that thing that I have to do, whether it's a doctor's appointment at 2 o'clock. It's like, well, I can't do anything else today because I have a doctor's appointment at 2 o'clock. So my entire day is waiting for that 2 o'clock appointment.
Yep.
And yeah, I was recently summoned for jury duty. And I think part of my, a lot of my anxiety around that is also my experience with my son, Marco, and his death and being in the courts. And so there's a lot of anxiety around that, like a lot. And I even tried to get out of it, but it was denied. We won't go there. Explaining my anxiety around this. But part of that, part of the anxiety with that is that there's all these dates. It's like 3 months of random, like, I think I counted on, but there's like 35 dates that I don't know whether I have to be there or not until the night before.
That's crazy.
So I have to call the night before. Like this week, I had to call Monday to see if I need to show up on Tuesday. I had to call Thursday to see if I need to show up on Friday. And so that anticipatory, it's like, I can't do, in my mind, I'm like, I cannot do anything for the next 3 months. Because I have all of these dates where I may or may not be tied up. So it's just that anticipatory anxiety of not knowing and worry about like how that's going to affect my regular routine or my kids' routine or like my niece is getting married. And so there's a lot of things going on with her wedding. And it's just all this anxiety around the unknown.
Yeah.
So... yeah, it's, and also for me, so you said you had anxiety your whole life. I don't know that I have. For me, my husband was diagnosed with anxiety after we got married, and I recently shared that in our small group, and I was laughing. I was like, I didn't cause it, guys. It wasn't me. It wasn't that we got married.
I didn't even think about that.
It wasn't that we got married that causes anxiety. He had always had these, he had his first panic attack.
Yeah.
A couple of years after we got married and we were visiting his parents, we were at their house and something triggered him and he had a panic attack. Did not know what it was. No, none of us knew what it was because he had never experienced it.
Yeah.
We had never experienced it. He thought he was having a heart attack because that's what it feels like. So that's when he was diagnosed with anxiety for the first time. And for the longest time after that, I was like, I don't know how to help you because I don't feel anxious about anything. Like I just kind of work it out or move on. Or my dad was a big, I think it's a generational thing too. I think that Gen X and boomers, they underreport anxiety because we think everybody worries about stuff. Right.
Right.
But for me, my dad was also, I remember him saying this all the time. Don't worry about the things that you can't change or don't worry about the things you don't have any control over. It will be what it will be. And so that helped me, I think, for most of my life to not worry and not be anxious about, like, I still worried, but I wasn't anxious because it was like, I have no control over this.
Right.
I can't do anything about it. There's no point in worrying about it. And that's what he would say. There's no point in worrying about it. You can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And so I think that helped me for most of my life. But then when my dad was diagnosed with cancer, I had this anticipatory grief anxiety because I knew what was coming. And I think that's when it kind of started to surface. But after Marco passed away, like that's when I had my first panic attack. It was a couple of months after he passed away. And I was just sitting in my living room next to the window, and it was like I couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
And it was just this weight on my chest, and I felt like I was having a heart attack, and I was by myself. But thankfully, because Ben, I had walked with Ben through some of his panic attacks, I recognized like this is what's happening. Okay. And I was able to breathe through it and just realize this will pass. Just breathe through it. But that was the first panic attack I had. And then that's when I like so much more empathy and compassion for it, because I was like, oh, this is what that feels like. Oh my gosh, that's horrible. And you have no control over it.
Right.
Like I said, I don't even know what triggered me. I was just sitting next to the window in a chair. And then all of a sudden it was just, yeah, it was just a...
It's kind of like waves, kind of. Like it rolls over you almost.
Yeah. And that was like a specific panic attack. But know that like anxiety itself is kind of like, different for everybody.
Yeah.
One of my friends said, it feels like you're floating around. And I'm like, that's exactly it. It's like, I'm not anchored to anything. I'm not tethered to anything. I'm not grounded.
Yes.
And it feels like I'm just kind of floating around. Yes. And I don't like that. I want to be grounded to something.
That's good. I think this year I've been like coping with reading.
I love like to that's read.
Been that is what I've been using to
I think like help. For me, reading is also like a ritual, right? It's not just I'm sitting down and I'm reading a book. It's like I've got my spaces where like I want to sit down and read my book. It has to be kind of quiet, semi-quiet for me to focus on. My favorite reading time is by a fire with a hot drink, tea or coffee or something like that. Or in the spring or summer, reading outside on the porch. But anyway, I think the whole act of reading is very soothing, I think.
Yeah. You get to immerse yourself in a place where you're not, you know, at least for me, that's how I experience it. And kind of get to travel elsewhere and not really think about your world, or it can help you think about your world. It just depends on how you experience reading. But
I go through moods too, where I'll be into like the anxious generation, which we're talking about.
That's nonfiction.
Yeah. So that one's so full of information and statistics and research, and I'm loving it, right? I'm taking notes. I'm highlighting. I'm like, this is great, although I don't remember all of it.
Right.
But then it's like, that was a lot. Yeah. That hurt my brain a little bit, trying to hold in all that information. And so then I want something that's really light and really like fiction that's just easy and breezy. But then I want something that's really dramatic after that, you know?
Murder mystery.
Yeah, suspenseful thrillers. Yeah. And
But yeah, I think that...
It's a coping
skill
for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, a coping mechanism.
I think that exercise, like physical activity, is another good coping skill, but I don't do it. And I think that's actually...
I love that you just said that. Like
I don't
do it.
And I think
I don't do it.
But I don't do it. And I think that obviously doesn't help my anxiety, because also I'm an Enneagram 8 and I should definitely be getting that energy out. But I don't.
I think walking helps me a ton. And I will walk on a treadmill, but I love just going outside and walking. But you have to have the perfect conditions for that. You know, I'm not a rain walker. I don't enjoy that. That's not going to help my anxiety. That's probably going to cause more anxiety.
My thing is time. And I know a lot of people talk about, I don't have time. But it's not that I don't have time. I know that I have time to do this, and it's about prioritizing. But also here is the hyperactivity brain, right? When I'm doing it, I'm thinking about all the other things I need to be doing instead of that.
You could be using your time for that instead of walking. Yeah, I'm right there.
Yes.
I totally agree with you.
So it's a mind thing.
Yep. It's for lack of a better word. Unfortunately.
It takes a lot of energy to do the self-talk to get to a different side of it.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes once I've done the self-talk, it's like I'm just okay. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Like, I've just talked myself now into being okay. Yeah. And I don't have the energy to do anything else. I've basically just talked myself out of, like, a panic attack.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And now I need to rest.
Yes, for now. For now. We'll see what happens later today, but for now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we've already said this, but just to say again, is that anxiety presents itself different in everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And just being willing to recognize that and have compassion and empathy mm-hmm. for that is crucial.
Yeah.
And feeling seen. I have so much regret for the fact that, which it wasn't any fault of my own. I did not have a lens for it whenever Ben was going through it by himself. But I have so much regret for the fact that I couldn't see him and I couldn't walk with him through any of that because I didn't get it. I'm going to get emotional talking about it because I do have a lot of regret that I didn't get it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help him through that. And I know I said all the wrong things. Like, don't be anxious. Don't worry. Calm down. What are you so upset about? Right. You know, like, I just used the wrong language for it because I didn't know. Mm-hmm. But I also think, like, there's some grace that he gave 100%. Me and that we can give other people in knowing, like, they don't know.
They don't know.
I'm literally tearing up because it makes me emotional because I think, like, one of the worst feelings in the world is to not be seen.
Yeah.
And I just, anytime that I have ever intentionally or unintentionally made someone feel like they're not seen makes me feel sad.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Totally.
Yeah.
But I like what you said that there's grace for that, right? Because there's grace for if you don't know, like you, like people who don't experience this, they don't have words for it. They can have compassion.
Yes.
But it's really hard to fully empathize, really.
Because you don't understand.
Because you don't fully understand. You can try to put yourself in someone else's shoes, but you're never going to fully understand until you experience that yourself.
Which is why empathy is so important and not toxic in any way, shape, or form. I don't care what any of you have heard out there. Empathy is not toxic. It is a beautiful, loving thing and Jesus was the best example of empathy and what that looks like in human form. I think a big part of empathy is what we're talking about. It's like realizing I don't understand everything about other people. I don't even understand everything about myself.
Yeah.
How in the world can I expect to know someone else when I don't really know myself fully inside and out?
Yeah. That's what I love about learning about people. Because how am I supposed to even understand if I don't even know someone? Whenever I ask them about their life, that's when you can, I don't know people more, know more people more.
Yeah, for sure.
Is so helpful to even expand your own boundaries for empathy and like, compassion.
I know I've talked about the Enneagram a lot today, but I think that's because that was a turning point for me. So I've taken...
Well, especially the difference between you and Ben, too.
So I have taken a gajillion personality assessments and things. My bachelor's degree is in psychology, and there's a reason for that. Number one, I was super interested in it. I was fascinated by it, but also, like, I understood it.
Yeah.
And so I took a lot of personality assessments through my education, but then also take them on my own because I'm just a nerd for it. Yeah. But in all of that, the most accurate one that I have done, which is not even an actual personality assessment that's recognized by the American Psychological Association, but... the most accurate one I have ever taken was the Enneagram.
Yeah.
And not only did I feel talking about being seen, I felt so seen and also not alone. Like, oh my gosh, other people do this. It's not just a weird thing that I do, but also it helped Ben and I understand each other so much more. It gave us a lens to look through to kind of see each other better.
Yeah.
And it was a turning point for us. It was a turning point for me in general, but it was a turning point for us and how we communicate, how we understood each other. And I'll never forget one of the biggest things for me, the light bulb, whatever, was when we were talking about the Enneagram and he's an Enneagram 9. I'm an 8. And so we're talking about the tense in which you process or see the world, which is past, future, or present.
Right.
And so.
Oh, that was the biggest one for me.
Yeah.
Too.
So Enneagram 8 and a 7 too. You're a 7.
I'm a 7.
So we process things in future tense. We are constantly thinking ahead, thinking about what's next, planning
which
for.
Which I think causes a lot of anxiety.
Yes. Yes. Speaking of anticipating things. Yep. So we're planning for. What's going to happen next? Like tomorrow, next week, vacation, this summer. Like we are constantly in that future tense mindset. And Enneagram 9 is in the past tense. Mm-hmm. So my husband is not thinking about what we're going to do later today or tomorrow or next week. He's thinking about what happened yesterday, last night, this week. And he's reflecting on what happened. Not all the time. It's not like he always lives in the past. But and it's not like I always live in the future. But for the most part, that's the lens that he sees things through, which is he's reflecting on things that have already happened. And I'm thinking about things that haven't happened yet.
Right.
And so one of the ways this is a silly way, but one of the ways this came up in our marriage was like on the weekend, like Saturday morning, we wake up and be like, what are we going to do today? It's a beautiful day. Let's get up. Let's get moving. Let's do this. Let's what's happening? And he's like, whoa. Like, not only is it a difference between being a morning person or not, but in his mind, he's like, I'm still thinking about last night's dinner or whatever. Mm-hmm. I am definitely not there yet. And it would frustrate me.
Right.
Because I just thought everybody should think like
new
this.
Day.
Yeah, I just thought everybody plans for the next step, right? We're moving in forward motion. How can you not be thinking in forward motion? And so that for me, I will never forget. We were sitting in the living room of the two people that were helping lead this whole, like the first time I ever walked through Enneagram. And when we were talking about the Enneagram 9 and how they see things in past tense, I remember went, what? And I looked at Ben and I went, you do? Like, are you kidding me? People think in past tense and not forward. Like, it was revolutionary for me.
It's
because
so funny.
Honestly, until that point, I just thought it was, like I said, boomers and Gen X with anxiety. We just think everybody has anxiety, so there's no point in talking about ours, right? I thought everyone thought future tense or future oriented. Never even occurred to me that there were people who thought past or people that are more present in the moment. And again, it's not like they never think about the future or the past. It's just that that's where most of their
revert to.
Yeah, most of their mindset is in the present tense. So anyway, I just think that I don't know where we were going with this, but it was such a turning point for me. I think empathy.
Yeah.
Like being able to talk, to see
once
that.
Once you understood him.
Yeah. Once I understood, that was huge.
Yeah.
We see the world, like our dispositions are completely different. Like we don't have the same lens.
Right.
That we see the world or that we hear the world, even hearing the world. So I talk loud and I talk fast. And he is like, would always say, why are you yelling at me? And I'm like, I'm not yelling. This is just how I talk. And so, but for him as the Enneagram 9, he hears things a little bit louder anyway.
Quieter processor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I am a loud talker by nature. Mm-hmm. And so for him that already hears things loudly, and for me who talks louder, like for him I was always yelling,
right?
Or I am, I didn't change. I still do. So I think that all points to the need for empathy and compassion and understanding that we are all different. Very, very different.
Yep.
We are all very similar in a lot of ways too. I think we have more similarities than we'll know because we don't take the time to learn that about each other. But also, like, we are very, very different. It's more than what you would think, right? It's more than you were homeschooled and I was not.
Right.
It's more than you have red hair and I have black. We process the world different. Mm-hmm. And that is a beautiful thing. It's not a bad thing. It is a beautiful thing because we are all made and created the way that we are made and created.
Yeah. Even siblings.
Yes.
You have the same household growing up, but like your parents are different ages when you're the same age as when they parented your older sibling at that age. You know, it's like even down to that, the same upbringing can be drastically different, even with no intentions of being completely different, because everyone's in a different season at different seasons. It's just so fascinating.
And we're shaped by different things.
Yeah.
Like, we have different traumas, and that's why eyewitness testimony is not very reliable, right? Because you and I can see the same thing and we can report it completely differently, mm-hmm. because we're shaped by our experiences, our DNA, our thought processes, our personalities, so many things, which all leads to be empathetic and compassionate towards people, because you don't know what they're going through. And it is not toxic. I don't even want to say this person's name who's coined the term toxic empathy, because I don't want to give it any space on our space. But it is like, it is wrong.
It's ludicrous.
Empathy. It's ludicrous. Empathy is not, nor has it ever been, toxic. And if you feel like someone is exploiting your empathy, so what? Set a boundary and move on. But empathy, by and large, in the way that God created it, that Jesus exemplified it, is not, nor was it ever, nor could it ever be, toxic, period.
Yeah. I think that was a really good point too, like, set a boundary if it is being exploited.
Yeah.
And that's and you move on.
Right.
Yeah, that's not what empathy is.
No, people can exploit, manipulate anything.
Yep.
It kind of reminds me of when you see someone, a homeless person that's asking for food or money or whatever, and I don't know how many times I have heard they're probably just going to use the money for drugs or whatever. And it's like, you know what? And if that's how you feel about it, then you don't have to give them any money. You don't have to give them a bottle of water. You don't have to do that. If that's how you feel, you can set that boundary, and that is okay. And I will have empathy for you in setting that boundary. But if I feel compelled or called to hand them money or hand them water or hand them food or whatever, then that's also on me. And if that is being exploited, then so be it.
I think a really good thing too to consider is, we do not know how God calls people.
Amen.
Because I could be called to not give someone money. You could be called to give someone money. Mm-hmm. And I should therefore not judge you for giving that person money, because I don't know what's going on in your heart between you and God.
Preach.
If that's what's motivating you to do that. And I don't know.
Yes.
I'm not you.
Yes.
And so I should not be inserting myself to tell you what to do because of my experience in life.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I could go, we go so many different ways with this. I'm also thinking about your own personal experience, right? I'm thinking about servers, for example. This is a really easy example. Like, I know a lot of people that have worked in the food service industry are really good tippers because they've been there.
Right.
They're like, I remember what it was like waiting tables and working for tips, so they tip really well. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people who maybe don't have that reference point, they might just be average tippers.
And even if they are good tippers, they're still not going to be like, I see you.
Yes, they don't have that reference point. So again, we're shaped by our experiences. Everybody has a different story and a different reason. But for me, I have a lot of compassion for people who are down on their luck or who find themselves in a situation that they never wanted to be in, because I've been in situations that I had no choice in. There were times where my dad was unemployed. There were times where I don't remember because I was too young. Mm-hmm. But there were also times where I couldn't rely on them for this. And I was living on ramen noodles. Yeah. And at one point, I was literally sleeping on friends' couches. Mm-hmm. And I had everything packed up in my Jeep Cherokee. And I was not on the streets because I had support, but I didn't have financial support because my parents couldn't financially support me. And so I didn't have like a job yet or a career. But I realize how easily people can be in situations like that, especially people with families or kids that they're trying to support or whatever the case may be. And so that's my lens.
Mm.
It's not everybody's lenses. A lot of people have compassion for people that's not their experience. But that just explains a little bit of like the compassion I have for people where like I've been not in that situation, but it could have easily been a situation like that. And so that's my lens of reference.
Right.
And we all have our own lenses. Yeah. So anyway, talking about anxiety, and we turn to empathy, which that's fine.
No, I think that's part of I think that's part of the conversation, though, because the anxious generation, why would you even care about reading this book or learning how to help people cope with being anxious if you don't have the empathy or the lens
that's
to
very
do
true.
That.
If you don't have empathy, you're not going to even read this book.
Yeah.
You're not going to try to understand what's
because
going on.
Because we all worry, right?
Oh. Right. So a couple of things from the anxious generation. One of the things that really stood out to me as a parent was comparing supervised play and unsupervised play.
Ooh.
Even though you're Gen Z and I'm Gen X slash millennial slash millennial, we probably have a very similar experience in how old we were when we were allowed to explore outside of our house without our parents on your farm in my neighborhood.
Right.
And it, I mean, young. Mm-hmm. I don't even know, like maybe 8, 9. But I remember riding bikes with my friends, walking to their houses, be home before the streetlights come on, checking in. I would run into the house and open the door and say, I'm checking in, mm-hmm. and then leave again.
Aww.
Yeah, we had a lot of freedom growing up to explore. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, Jonathan calls that unsupervised play. So we had a lot of unsupervised play, and we didn't have a lot of tech or screen time.
Right.
Like even TV, we didn't have where you can stream whatever you want to stream whenever you want to stream it. Yeah. I had to get up early on Saturday mornings if I wanted to watch cartoons, because if I slept in too late, they were over.
Right.
And I just missed out. So he talks a lot about that and how today's generation, it's flipped, where we're not supervising the screen time, which we should be supervising. Mm-hmm. And there's been this flip where parents are kind of hovering over play, and we're not letting them have unsupervised play and the freedom. And he makes a really good point that unsupervised play when we're younger is where we learn social cues, where we learn to pick up on nonverbal communication. We learn to read people. And sitting across from you face to face, I can read your expression, whether you're upset about something, excited about something. You learn you learn how to like take turns.
Yeah.
Like you just learn a lot of things by unsupervised play.
Right.
You learn how to figure things out. You learn that sometimes somebody's going to take your toy away and that's going to make you feel a certain way. And you have to
process
and work through that.
True.
So his argument is that today's generation, parents are supervising all of that. Even their playtime is very supervised and scheduled and constructed. And meanwhile, we hand them an iPad or a video game or whatever, and we're not supervising that. Mm. And I feel a little seen by this. I'm not going to lie. I'm like, yeah, because it's easy, because we're busy.
There.
We're busy parents. And sometimes it's really easy to be like, okay, here, fine, sit here and watch this while mommy cooks dinner or whatever.
Right.
So the other day, my 13-year-old, who he walks around the neighborhood and we let him walk to and from his friend's house. But I was thinking about that. Like, when did that start? When he was like 12 or 13. That's when that started.
Right.
He asked me if he could go for a walk. Yeah, sure. No problem. And then he asked me if he could take his little brother. And I was like, a lot of anxiety around this.
Yeah.
Also, speaking of experience, my experience with losing a child who was hit by a car.
Yeah.
Driven by a drunk driver, a lot of anxiety around anybody going for a walk, period.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
So I was like, okay, yes, I'm going to let you do that.
Wow.
And I went over some rules, you know, just like safety things. But then I was like, okay, have fun. Don't go far. And I realized as a parent, like, I'm not used to doing that kind of thing,
yeah.
like, and letting go. But it's good for them. And I saw something on Instagram where a mom did this, and she was talking about this book, The Anxious Generation. And she, like, for each of their kids, they let them do some activity independent.
Mm.
And the thing she was letting her, I think, 8-year-old do was she parked in Chick-fil-A where she could see him.
Okay.
Go in the restaurant, and he went in by himself and ordered their food and brought it back out to the car.
Aww.
And I was just like, wow, this is a really good thing. Because
yeah.
I also think of other Gen Zs I know that are terrified to talk on the phone, to make a doctor's appointment, to order food, to do a lot of things, because everything that we can do, like even me, I've gotten so accustomed to ordering DoorDash.
Right.
When a new restaurant opens up, I'm like, oh, I've never been in there before. And it's like, it's a restaurant, Liz. Just walk in and order.
Listen. But like, listen, at work, if I can email someone, I will be emailing them and not calling them. And I didn't, because I hate that.
Right. And we didn't grow up with all this technology, but I have still become so accustomed to it that my anxiety, we were talking about this the other day, when I don't do something, my anxiety is heightened about that thing.
Yes.
Like traveling.
Well, and
like traveling. Yeah. Like I have all this travel anxiety when we went to Florida with our staff a couple weeks ago because I haven't been in a while. And so all of this unknown stuff, right?
Yep.
And so I notice this when I rely on the technology to do all these things, then I get anxious about going into a restaurant and ordering food because I just don't do it. And I'm like, what is wrong with, what is wrong with you, Liz? My 13-year-old can go in there and order food. This 8-year-old just went inside Chick-fil-A and ordered food. And I'm like, oh, can I order it ahead of time? It's so stupid, but it's not because it's real.
It is real. Okay. So I think of like self-checkout. Mm-hmm. I always go for self-checkout. Mm-hmm. Like, and honestly, there's not really very many places anymore that have cashiers. I mean, there are some, but the self-checkout is just like, that's what people do.
Yeah.
Well, I saw this study and I need to find it. I actually was looking for it this past week to talk about it on this podcast, but I couldn't find it. But there's some study that the more that you have stranger interaction in your day-to-day life actually makes you less anxious.
Mm, that's a good point. Another thing he talks about in the anxious generation is that the 80s, early 90s was the height of stranger danger.
Oh. Interesting.
And so that began the shift of people are dangerous and stay away from people that you don't know, all in an effort to keep kids safe. And part of that was because of stories of abductions and abuse and things like that were more accessible to us.
Okay.
Through the media.
Oh, more accessible. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting too.
It makes me think about also like another reason for anxiety is the overload of information and how we're not meant to consume as much. And I'm not even talking about news.
Right.
I'm talking about we're here podcasting. Mm-hmm. Someone's texting me. Someone could be calling me, like another person. Someone
you're
could
accessible.
Be. Yeah, but I'm here right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking to whoever. I'm talking to you. But my mind is like, oh, you got to respond to that person because they're talking to you, but that's not my current conversation. And all of these things build up in my head and compound. And I'm also thinking about my grandparents who I need to keep in contact. You know, all of these people that I need to keep in contact with. And it's so overwhelming.
Yes.
I know for me, it adds to it.
That's a good point. Ben always says if you're too available to people, then they will take advantage of that. Yeah. Not like in a bad way, but if you're too available, then they will come to you all the time. And then, it does make your anxiety. One of the things you talked about consuming information, I recently saw something too that was talking about how we weren't created to consume all of this information. And Jonathan talks about social media and the anxiety of Gen Z girls from social media and trying to be this certain way that of what they're seeing. Because you're seeing the highlight reel on social media. It's not real life.
Yeah.
It's the best of, but sometimes it's not real at all. It's all curated for them to put on their Instagram feed or TikTok. But so speaking of another thing, side note, I really noticed this with Pinterest, which is another form of social media, but I became a mom in this Pinterest era where all of these elaborate birthday party for your child and these 3-tiered cakes for your 4-year-old. And it was like, that's what a good mom does. A Pinterest mom is a good mom. And that's what that looks like. So, but back to what I was going with being accessible and the consuming of information. I saw something that said we were not created to hold all of this information. So the example of back in the day, way back in the day, the only information that you had was what was going on in your village or in your community or in your circle, basically. And that with the advances of technology, which aren't all bad, I'm not gonna say that, but when we're talking specifically about anxiety,
right,
with the advances of technology and having the accessibility to information, that we carry on the weight of the world literally because we know everything that's going on in the world at our fingertips. the point that this was making is that, like, we were not designed to carry the weight of all of the things that are bad in the world. And all of the news that's coming out about, like, the wars and the genocide. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be informed.
Right.
And
right.
that we shouldn't have compassion and that we shouldn't, like, advocate. But we can only do so much.
Yeah.
We can only yeah. hold so much space for those things and advocate for so much. We cannot solve all the problems of the world. But when you have access to all the problems of the world at your fingertips and you want to do something about right. that and your heart breaks for those things, then naturally that leads us to feel very anxious.
And burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
Because that feeling of helplessness.
Yes.
Because you can't change it.
Yes.
But
you want to.
Yeah, but you want to. Like, what are... Yeah, I don't know. You feel so helpless.
Yeah. Like, you want to do something, but you can't do anything. And then you feel defeated too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming.
Is what it is. And then you feel selfish when you try to focus on what you can
mm-hmm.
have an influence on or advocate for or have space for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like your circle and your family and your community. And then you feel selfish because it's right. like, well, what about the other people in the world? You know, and it adds to the anxiety of it all, I guess.
I know. And it's crazy because I know the level that I experience anxiety and I don't even have kids.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm like, honestly, some days I feel like I can't even speak to this really because I don't have that added layer of responsibility and caring yeah. for other humans that has to have so much anxiety to go along with it. Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
And I know that my story is valid. I get that.
Absolutely valid.
But like, also, I feel like I am on a lesser tier of it because there's not that added layer. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but I would disagree because just because you're not a parent doesn't mean that you can't have so many other things that you are.
I guess I am sort of a parent. I'm a dog mom.
But even so, I think that even if you're not a parent of animals or children, that you still can experience anxiety on a level that is different from what mm-hmm. I experience
yeah.
it on. I think it's different. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's less or it's
right.
more.
It's
I just think it's different. To your point, I remember when I took a positive pregnancy test for my firstborn child, and it was like my stomach flipped when I saw that positive pregnancy test. And I looked at my husband and I said, and there it is. And he goes, what? And I said, worry. I am going to worry about this child for the rest of my life, starting right now. And I was right.
Yep. I have heard my dad say that my whole entire life. You're like, I'll always worry about you.
Yeah.
But
yeah. And I think, again, I
don't personally understand that yet.
Right. And I think it just takes a different form.
Yeah.
I don't think it's less or it's more. I just think it's a different form.
Yeah.
Of worrying about your children.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And yeah. it's like not a bad thing either. It's a good worry because you love them and want the best for them. And so I totally get that. But that's a different thing entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a couple of highlights from this book other
yeah,
than the
please.
Ones that we've already talked about. Just a couple of things that his research highlights. Like I said, a lot of harms of social media, especially with teenage girls. Some of those harms are sleep deprivation, attention fragmentation. And I'm like, whoa, I experienced
wow.
that big time. And obviously addiction. He emphasizes that children are what he calls anti-fragile and require some level of adversity and challenge early in life in order to develop resilience. Which
wow.
I thought was such a good point because we treat children like they are so fragile and that they're going to fall apart. But then what I think happens is because we treat children that way when they become adolescents or adults, or at any point in time when they come up against something that's really, really hard and difficult, they have anxiety because they don't know how to manage it because we've treated them like they're so fragile they'll fall apart if they experience any type of heartache.
Wow.
And so I think that's a very good point that he makes, that children are anti-fragile and they require some level of adversity and challenge early in life in order to develop resilience. The decline in play-based childhoods and the rise of overprotective parenting, which we talked about, combined with increased screen time, have deprived children of essential experiences that build coping mechanisms. And of course, he advocates also for collective action, like policy changes and improved parental controls. One of the points he makes is that a lot of websites that are for adults only, they don't do anything to confirm that it is an adult that's logging in or accessing their site. They just ask, are you 18 and up?
Right.
And so if you are a 15-year-old boy who wants to see that information, then all it takes is clicking yes.
Yeah.
Some sites will ask for a birth date, but still all it takes is a little bit of math.
Yeah. you know? Put that ear up. Yeah.
Yeah. And he encourages outdoor play to combat mental health crisis among the youth, which I think is another really good point. It's a really good book, and I recommend reading it. It's a lot of information. So for me, I think reading this book opens the door to have some conversations because there's so much information where you're like, wow, that's really good. Or like, I want to talk to you about it and like get your thoughts on it. So I think that's good. There's a statistics he shares too on the anxiety level of Gen Z that has gone up. Depression became 2.5%, 2.5 times more prevalent between 2010 and 2015. So we're talking before the COVID epidemic.
Oh, okay.
And so he shares a lot of this surge in anxiety and what happened, where he was able to kind of point between 2010 and 2015, because we think about, well, this happened, like the Twin Towers, right? Like that happened. So obviously children are more anxious, but he debunks that because every generation has had their things that has caused a lot of anxiety. So it's not the circumstances of the world.
Events.
Yeah. So his point is, but like what specifically changed? If you try to compare world events, there's always been things with every generation that would have sparked anxiety. So he talks a lot about the invention of the smartphone and the forward facing camera on the smartphone and the rise of social media. So yes, all this pointed to the increase in anxiety. Again, it more than doubled.
Yeah.
In between 2010 and 2015.
I have a thought on that. Also, I would say the camera in your phone at all times. I think that if you're going out with your friends or you say something silly or do something like, you know, like how people have done in the past. Having that videoed or the possibility of having that videoed and that always being there. That would cause a lot of anxiety, like that never going away.
Yeah. So anything
or that being sent to your friends at school without you knowing, you know, just like little things like that.
Anything that you do can now be recorded and blasted on social media or wherever. Like even if you're sitting in the red light in your car at a red light picking your nose. Like
I literally do that all the time.
Like somebody could record you and put you on blast and be like, look at this chick.
She picks her nose all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you never know what will or won't go viral. Like people always want to go viral for good things.
Yeah.
But like also like bad things can go. And then we live in this cancel culture. Not as much anymore, but still.
Oh, yeah.
Where you could be having a bad day or a bad moment and that's caught on video and someone puts that out there and then your reputation is ruined.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a very good point. He talks about how this isn't just Gen Z. There's obviously a lot of spillover with millennials. And here's where I heard the anxiety definition. He said it's the fear in anticipation of future or perceived threats.
Oh.
So it doesn't even have to be an actual threat. It can just be
perceived.
What you perceive a threat to be. Perceived or an actual threat. But anticipation of a future perceived or actual threat.
Wow.
And his research also shows changes in thought patterns. It hits girls harder than it did boys. He says Gen Z teens had a mental health collapse between this time frame. Here's an interesting statistic. In 2022, 46% of teens, almost half of teens, reported that they are online almost constantly.
Yeah.
Half of your teen population is like, I'm almost always online. And he also said, we are forever elsewhere. Mm. And I thought that is very true.
Wow. Yeah.
So we've lost the ability to be fully present because we are forever elsewhere. He calls it the great rewiring of childhood. He said, people don't get depressed when they feel threats collectively, but when they feel isolated, lonely, or useless.
Absolutely.
And that collective anxiety can actually bind people together. But I think that loneliness of Gen Z boys is also playing for people of a predatory nature to recruit them for causes that are not necessarily good causes. Mm-hmm. They're preying on their loneliness and their want to belong somewhere.
Yep.
And they're like, hey, we have a space for you. And they're appealing to all of the things that they think they want.
Yep.
And they are recruiting them in masses. That would be a good discussion for another time.
I think we should talk about that. And also, you should watch the TV series Adolescence.
Okay.
I watched it this week. That could coincide with that conversation very well. Okay. It's a four-part series.
Maybe we'll just carry this conversation on because I feel like there's just a lot to talk about.
There's a lot to talk about. Do part one and part two. I think that would be great.
The anxious generation. Like, we have barely even tapped into it, honestly. But maybe that's a good conversation for next time. But yeah, I would like, I will watch that. And we'll talk about it. But I also, as someone who has a teen boy, I really want to talk about why Gen Z boys are being targeted by certain media, by certain groups.
Yep.
And then also teen girls. There's a whole thing to unpack there. I recently watched some stuff on like other things that involve
that are giving cliffhangers
that are preying on girls and Gen Z and young adults by putting out this facade of this is what life should look like,
right?
Even though my life doesn't look like this. And then also I have some product for you to buy that can make me rich in the process of you trying to have this life that's not real. It's a whole other thing to unpack. Maybe we'll do that next time. So, final thoughts. Does this matter?
Yes.
100%.
Yes. Well, this book just proves that everyone struggles with anxiety, and that can manifest in so many different ways. And I think, too, for me, understanding that, and also, it's a both and, seeing people for who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could do well in the fight with this anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you said, the collective anxiety is not as big of a deal.
It makes you feel better when you're like, oh, it's not isolating. Just me.
Yes.
I'm not the only one who feels this way.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think that matters because, I mean, we all saw through COVID the isolation that entailed, and even smartphones, you feel like you're talking to people, but you're alone,
right?
Physically alone. Mm-hmm. And so that has a lot of harm.
Yeah.
I think as well. So I think this matters immensely.
I think it matters. I think having conversations like this are crucial. This generation is doing a much better job of communicating and talking about things that are hard to talk about. They get a bad rep. Millennials and Gen Z, we talk about they're all in their feelings. It's all about feelings, and feelings aren't facts. But anxiety it's real, and it affects so many things. And so I think it's important not only that we have space where information is out there, but it's important that we have space where we hear other people's stories. Mm-hmm. And we validate their stories and their feelings, and we let them know you're not alone in this, and other people feel this way too. And it might look a little bit differently, but you're not alone in this, and that you're seen. So one of my favorite names for God is El Roy, because it means the God who sees me.
Oh,
and I just
that.
Think there's something so special and powerful and loving about a God who sees you, and to know that you are seen for who you are,
yes,
anxiety and all, and that you are still loved is so meaningful and powerful.
Amen.
And so I think that this 1000% matters.
Yeah.
I want to know what everybody else thinks that's listening. I know that whoever's listening has an anxiety story that you can relate to. Yeah, or experience. You don't have to share that if you don't want to, but if you feel comfortable or if you think it would be helpful to share that, please share it in our comments on Instagram, send us an email, or just share your own story about it if you feel so compelled so that other people know, hey, me too. I'm not alone in this. Somebody else out there feels this way. And just talk about it. Just have a conversation. We would love to hear from you. Or if you want to share your own story and tag us in it, whatever you feel like you need to do. But I would just encourage, let's talk about it. Let's have this conversation. Let's keep it going. Let's hear your thoughts.
This was a good conversation.
Yeah, to be continued, I hope. But in the meantime, you've been listening to From Ecstasy Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
And we'll talk to you later. Bye, guys.
Bye.